I will do as my predecessor. Is this on? People can hear me in the back. Okay. I'm here representing Panyasastra University in the annual review of the Globus campus program, in which several universities, mine included, work with TUFS to develop courses on peace, conflict, sources of conflict, conflict resolution. So I'm very pleased to have been invited to give you some ideas of some of the current research going on or planned for another consortium I'm in, which is called the Cambodia Research Consortium. So you are not getting a paper today on completed research, but rather on a conceptual framework that we hope we can use to examine these problems in a very troubled state and a troubled society, that of Cambodia. Hopefully some of this conceptual framework can then be utilized beyond the state of Cambodia or the case of Cambodia. And I would very much look forward to your feedback on whether this framework, which I will discuss in a few minutes, is indeed feasible, or is it only going to be possible to implement it in a particular case, and perhaps is it even implementable? But let me get that to that as I go on. I should also mention here in passing that we have just established another consortium consisting of five universities coming out of the Global Campus Program. These are the universities of Afghanistan, Sri Lanka, Indonesia, and we want to work with TUFS on this. Another project coming out of this is peace and human security, which we will try to examine. Let me spend just a couple of minutes on the consortium, the Cambodia Research Consortium. I am here hooking back into what Professor Isasaki said yesterday, that it's not just enough to be studying peace and conflict, but is there something we can do about it? Can we alleviate conflict? Can we prevent it? Can we move beyond firefighting, as I think he was saying? So the consortium is a mixed group of people. It's made up of a private and some public universities in Cambodia, some universities from outside Cambodia, peace practitioners, NGO workers, a lot of NGOs, international and local, in Cambodia. So we are trying to work both on the conceptual part of what causes conflict and how they can be prevented, and also on the practical implementation of policy recommendations. So we intend to do not just political science and social science, but perhaps also policy science, meaning that we will have some recommendations we want to send on to those who make decisions. Now, of course, sending a recommendation to a decision maker doesn't mean that he or she will necessarily listen to what we have to say, but at least it is better than ensconcing ourselves in the ivory tower doing academic research that maybe nobody will read, or only colleagues of ours in other ivory towers. So this is what we hope we can do. And we do have one advantage. Cambodia is a donor-dependent country. Every year there is at least one NGO forum in which the government, including the prime minister, have to come and listen to what the people who give him money want. And so we think that we're going to be able to make our research product part of some of the recommendations coming out of the NGO forum. So it appears that perhaps the Prime Minister will have to listen, but then will he pay attention? That's another question. And so we will see how that works as we go along. Okay, now I apologize for not having a written paper, but I will turn the blame around a little bit. I got a request for a presentation 2 days before I was on the plane for Tokyo, and there was no time to develop a formal presentation or a paper. So what I did was to provide an abstract, and I will talk on the main points in this abstract. And this is the abstract, if you will, the conceptual framework that we will try to deal with in Cambodia. There are a number of caveats, which I will get to later on, but let me first try to tell you what's in the abstract itself. The theme, broadly speaking, is development and conflict in post-communist or in post-conflict systems. There are a number of concepts here that need to be defined. I have listed some of them at the beginning of the abstract. Conflict, violence, peace, change, development, transition, corruption, and threshold of tolerance. So I begin with a level of analysis statement. Conflict can occur because of individuals, groups, intergroup relationships, interstate relations, relations between non-state actors, and relationships rooted in the globalization process. Conflict can be peaceful or violent. And yesterday, Professor Cork talked about debilitating conflict, which I think is a very interesting concept that I would like to adopt if he doesn't have copyright on it. And if he has copyright on it, can you possibly waive it for us in Cambodia? All right. A conflict can be peaceful, then violent, or debilitating. So it can be constructive or destructive. In fact, I think we need to realize, as someone said yesterday, that conflict is part of the human condition. And I might even go as far as to say that conflict is essential in human relationships. It's the question of what kind of conflict. Democracy, for example, is based on the notion of continuing conflict, settlement of conflict, compromise between differing positions. It is just that presumably in democracy, these conflicts are settled in a peaceful way. It is also the case, I think, that progress, if you want to talk about conditions of life improving for people, a conflict is a necessity, that it is unlikely that political and other elites will change things just out of the goodness of their hearts. They will change things because they are being challenged. So this is an essential feature, I think, of human life. So peace includes conflict, but this kind of conflict that is contributing to solutions. And so, of course, there's the notion of conflict transformation, which I will mention briefly as well. So peace, of course, can be defined as the peace, as Tacitus did, of the desert. There's nobody there, so of course there's peace. There can also be peace if you kill all your opponents. That's peace also. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the kind of peace that comes from peaceful settlement, meaningful settlement of conflict. That conflict, therefore, is an essential feature of peace. Okay. Now, an important feature of violence is structural violence, defined by several people, for example, Johan Galtung. And so this is another aspect that this project will deal with. What is the role of structural violence in producing violent conflict, shooting conflict? Another variable in the topic is change. There are many kinds of change, but I choose to focus on various forms of development, political, socioeconomic, cultural, for example, as another variable. Yesterday, it was mentioned here that development, sustainable development, is a very important feature. There is a considerable literature on another concept I deal with, and that's transitional systems. I choose to focus on a kind of transition, namely the transition from authoritarianism to democracy. More specifically, I will discuss the concept of transition from authoritarianism to democracy in post-conflict societies, and specifically post-conflict Cambodia. Now, having said what I just said about conflict, of course, there is no such thing as a society without conflict. When I talk about Cambodia as a post-conflict society, I mean the absence of a shooting war or a civil war. Cambodia, of course, had the Khmer Rouge, and then many years subsequently of a civil war. That's over. On the other hand, Cambodia has a great deal of structural violence, which we can discuss what that means, with potential for a resurrection of a shooting war. get to that. So, the problems to be examined can then be stated as follows. After society experiences serious conflict, violent conflict, the post-conflict path of development, and I put that in quotation marks, because there are many different perceptions of what development is, or kinds of development. So the post-conflict path of development may take several forms. If the post-conflict society moves from authoritarianism to democracy, and from a state-controlled economy to a free market economy, what kind of transition process can be expected? Will development produce more conflict, less conflict, or conflict in different forms? Will this process help produce a functioning civil society? So will the process produce constructive or destructive conflict? Another focus of this research is conflict transformation. If the process produces destructive conflict, how can it be managed in such a way that the conflict can be transformed into long-term change that will reduce conflict in the future? More specifically, one way to reduce conflict in a transitional system is for the political and socioeconomic elites to exercise power on the principle of noblesse oblige. Such a policy will reduce the sources of structural violence that are likely to develop in transitional systems. The opposite of this is a political and societal elite that ignores the people and will rule for itself. Of course, Socrates discussed this problem over 2,000 years ago, so we're now dealing with a new problem configuration here. A specific focus of this research is also the notion of threshold of tolerance. What level of exploitation will the masses of the people or specific groups tolerate before the conflict created in the process turns violent, for example, revolution? And finally, what is the role of corruption in transitional societies? And you can tell that we're going to have a focus on Cambodia here, where corruption is endemic. So what is the role of corruption in transitional societies? We know from the literature that corruption is endemic, and perhaps particularly in these kinds of systems. There is consensus that corruption is a bad thing, basically hindering, again, development. On the other hand, corruption may ameliorate the problems associated with change, at least temporarily, in that it may reduce the likelihood of elites fighting each other for the spoils. After all, if everyone gets a cut, there may be less need to fight about it. This process, of course, produces massive structural violence suffered by those who are not part of the spoiled system. What is the threshold of tolerance for those who are being exploited in this way? At what point will they rise up and produce violent conflict? It is possible that this last part constitutes an impossible task. There may be too many variables at the individual or group level, or perhaps also interstate level, to make the threshold problem researchable. On the other hand, if some approximate findings may be established, the project may have both academic and policy implications. The study of the sources of conflict is an academic enterprise, but the search for peace is not. Peace workers are practitioners as well as analysts. If we can find some fairly accurate indicators of the threshold of tolerance, maybe these findings can help rapacious leaders turn to noblesse oblige, if only for the reason of self-preservation. Okay, now, some caveats. First of all, there are a great many variables here, and it may be very difficult, perhaps impossible, to be able to attribute a particular risk or a particular behavior or a particular source of conflict to any one of these variables. That's always a problem in multivariate analysis. And particularly the notion of threshold. How do we know what particular act or what particular process may tip a group or an individual even over the threshold of tolerance and into violence? Yet I think this is still worthwhile doing. And it is something that is not, of course, entirely new. It's been attempted before to deal with it. What I think is new here is that this is a systematic attempt, or hopefully systematic attempt, to deal with a country that is poorly researched on these issues. For example, There's no shortage of history of conflict and violence in Cambodia. For example, the Khmer Rouge period from 1975 to 79. Yet the work that has been done on it deals essentially with the behavior, ideas and behavior of the top political leadership, the so-called UNCA. It does not deal with the question of how did so many people become members of the Khmer Rouge? Why did they become members? What was the reason for this? What was the specific, or what were the specific sets of policies or circumstances that made peasant boys and even girls of very young age go out and become part of this murderous organization? Was it the exploitation that they and their parents had experienced personally? Was it the Cambodian tradition of leadership, which doesn't really accord any kind of responsibility on part of the leadership? Cambodian leaders have always defined power literally as possessing the people. Possessing the people means the people don't have any rights. You simply possess them. You consume them. Another interpretation is consuming the people. Is it that kind of leadership that eventually produced the circumstance that brought illiterate peasant boys and girls and others into this organization to clean up the system? Was it the nationalism advocated by Pol Pot and his people, the nostalgic notion of getting back to the time of Angkorian greatness? All of these are things that could have been studied about the Khmer Rouge, and we didn't do it. Our focus at this point is more to examine the present conditions, where society may be going from here, what kinds of friction will develop or is already in the society, and again, what is the threshold of tolerance for these kinds of examples of structural violence. If we know something about the threshold, perhaps it's possible to prevent structural violence from becoming real violence, meaning a shooting war or a genocidal war. There's some other caveats here. Most of the conceptual material here is based on a very substantial literature. Right? There is a huge literature on revolution, on war, intrastate war, interstate war, on development, just on the very question of different paths to development. Is it the IMF path based on the Western experience? I think my Indonesian colleague can tell you some of the after effects of the IMF imposing that model of development on Indonesia in the late 1990s. Is it the Sri Lankan model, sort of a development from the bottom up? So there are many different kinds of development paths. So that's been researched in great detail. Then the notion of transitional system, a huge literature. And we can go through all these concepts and say that there really isn't anything conceptually new in what we are doing. I think what is new, as I said before, is we are taking existing conceptual frameworks, trying to put them together and using this framework systematically, hopefully systematically, in an effort both to produce meaningful social science and also to produce some policy science, some recommendations. And then the question then becomes not so much whether the political leaders will be forced to listen to us, but will they pay any attention? And so why don't I stop here, but simply ask for input from anyone as to two very important questions, I think, here. Is this kind of multivariable, multifaceted conceptual framework indeed implementable? And can we, in the end, come up with something that isn't so broad that it signifies almost nothing or explains nothing? It's possible to have explanations that explain everything, but in the end, it hasn't really done much in terms of gathering information or improving our understanding either of the problem or of the things we have to do. In any case, that's where we hope we can go, and I'm hoping also that the Cambodia Consortium will be able to work with the consortium we are talking about, or we are establishing for the member universities of the conflict, peace and conflict, or global campus program, so that we can have a form of synergy, that what we do in one field can help us do things in another field. So let me stop here before the watchdogs, who have a 10-minute and 5-minute and a big red time is up before they show me that. I'll avoid that particular conflict, and I will quit at this point. Thank you.
Thank you very much for being considerate with the time. Thank you for stopping before the end of time conflict. And the consortium, the Global Campus, is covering Afghanistan, Cambodia, and Indonesia, Sri Lanka universities through teleconferences. We are engaged in common classes and courses. They are very useful, and we are trying to advance these programs going forward. In the discussion, what I found interesting is corruption. Of course, corruption basically is considered to be a bad thing, but Professor mentioned that there is a role that corruption might play in transitional societies. In that phase of transition, it may as well ameliorate problems. And he used the word noblesse oblige, that the elite might comply with the principle of noblesse oblige, or they may not. In societies where the elite do not exercise the role according to the principle of noblesse oblige, then that leads to more destructive situations. I am an expert of the Middle East, but I believe that this applies to many different regions, including Asia and Middle East conflict zones. And we would like to come back into more details in the discussion. We have had two presentations, so for 15 minutes, we will break for coffee. After the coffee break, we will invite Professor Abelardo Brenes, Professor Muhadi Sugiono for their presentations. Then, after that, we will invite Dr. Caravella for the comment. Then there will be lunch. After the lunch, we will have questions and answer sessions. So, ladies and gentlemen, please note your questions or comments so that you can remember what you want to say after the lunch. We are looking forward to the discussion. So, we will have a coffee break for 15 minutes. Thank you.